Hello, my name is Dave Emery, and this is Side 2 of For the Record Program Number 586, Miscellaneous Articles and Updates. This has been recorded on February 19th of the year 2007. Before we plunge into Side 2, please again, do make use of the tremendous and growing body of information that's available on the Spitfire website at www.spitfirelist.com and the various linked websites, both websites that are maintained or addresses that are maintained, pages that are maintained by Spitfire and by sister station WFMU, and some other links as well. On Side 1, in fact, for all of Side 1, we took a look at an article by Edwin Black from the San Francisco Chronicle of January 7th of 2007 about a subject that we've covered for many, many years here, namely the relationship between General Motors and the Third Reich. We're going to kick off Side 2 by taking a look at a relationship between one of the principal commercial banks in recent German history, one that also had a great deal to do with financing Nazi Germany and its various enterprises. And we're going to take a look at that bank, specifically Deutsche Bank's capital ventures into the former Soviet Union, because there has been speculation on a Russian website, the Kommersant website, which does not appear to be a tabloid website, so it appears to be fairly substantive in terms of credibility. There has been speculation, there was speculation last fall, that eventually Deutsche Bank could wind up owning the stock of Yukos, the giant Russian oil company, and that also this might place Deutsche Bank and or other German financial institutions in a position to largely control elements of the Russian fossil fuel industry. From Kommersant, spelled K-O-M-M-E-R-S-A-N-T, from October 16th of 2006, Yukos assets to become German. Deutsche subheaded, Deutsche Bank is ready to redeem Yukos' debts to Gazprom's benefit. Yukos chairman of the board, Viktor Gerashenko, told Kommersant that Deutsche Bank is in talks about redeeming debts and buying the controlling stock of Yukos. If Deutsche Bank manages to carry this out, it will have in its hands the fate of the major current corporation conflict in Russia's economy, that of Gazprom and Rosneft. Two independent sources in the investment banking sphere told Kommersant last week that Deutsche Bank and its Russian subsidiary Deutsche UFG are interested in Yukos assets. Yukos chairman of the board Viktor Gerashenko confirmed the information in his interview with Kommersant yesterday. He said last week he received a letter signed by Ilya Shcherbovich, head of the bank subsidiary in Russia, Deutsche UFG. The letter said that the bank is interested in purchasing, quote, Yukos' controlling stock, unquote, and is, quote, ready to undertake redeeming the company's debts. Deutsche Bank and Deutsche UFG refrained from giving comments on Sunday. Yukos said nothing about the situation either. Nikolai Lashkovich, spokesman for Yukos Bankruptcy Commissioner Edward Rebgen, said the commissioner's office does not know anything about the offer. However, Kommersant sources in investment banking say off the record that Deutsche UFG offered to purchase Yukos assets back in the early summer of 2006, but nothing was known about any steps to carry out this idea after that. Viktor Gerashenko said he does not know on whose behalf Deutsche Bank acts. Quote, we suggested they address Group Menatep Director Tim Osborne and gave all his contacts to them. I do not know whether any talks were held, yet amicable agreement is always possible, unquote, said Gerashenko, skipping down. Gazprom is one of the giant Russian natural gas companies. Gazprom spokesman Sergei Kuprianov refused to discuss Deutsche Bank's initiatives with Kommersant yesterday. Yet unlike Rosneft, Gazprom seems to be the most likely client of Deutsche Bank in those talks. Gazprom Chairman Alexei Miller met with Deutsche Bank Chairman Joseph Ackermann on October 9th, unexpectedly raising the question of the advanced repayment of Gazprom's credits attracted with the participation of Deutsche Bank. It's common practice to restructure the portfolio before large deals. So, at least according to this credible Russian website, there is a very real possibility that Deutsche Bank, one of the largest German commercial banks, will be gaining control of one or more giant Russian fossil fuel companies, thereby significantly changing the capital ownership of the fossil fuels industry that serves Europe. Certainly, if in fact the already significant relationship between German capital interests and the Russian fossil fuel industry solidifies to the point where Deutsche Bank does in fact purchase either controlling interest in either Yukos or Gazprom, it will represent a significant shift in ownership and control of the worldwide fossil fuels industry. We're going to jump next to another article, another subject, I should say, that I've covered for many years on this broadcast, namely the assassination of President Kennedy. One of the pieces of information that came out when Jim Garrison was investigating the JFK assassin in New Orleans in the 1960s, Garrison at that time was the city of New Orleans district attorney, one of the things that came out was that one of his suspects, Clay Shaw, was on the board of directors of a secretive international cabal, really. It was a company called Permindex with links to a number of different companies and countries around the world. It has been suggested in the Italian press that, in fact, Centro Mondiale Commerciale and Permindex, the two faces of this organization, were really CIA fronts. And when the information eventually came out about the allegations that Permindex / Centro Mondiale Commerciale were CIA fronts, the company then promptly relocated itself to Johannesburg, South Africa, at that time the capital of the apartheid regime. There are a number of interesting fascist luminaries who played prominent roles in Centro Mondiale Commerciale Permindex, including Mussolini's former Minister of Agriculture and also a son-in-law of former Nazi Finance Minister Hjalmar Horace Greeley, Schacht. And again, Clay Shaw, the primary suspect of Jim Garrison's investigation, or the primary focal point of Jim Garrison's investigation after the death of David Ferry, and an individual cited by the deputy counsel of the House Select Committee on Assassinations as either a planner of or a cutout of the planners of JFK's assassination, Clay Shaw on the board of directors of Centro Mondiale Commerciale, another name in the Permindex / CMC orbit that has been surfaced by a number of investigators as a possible participant, or at least someone who was part of the milieu involved in the Kennedy assassination, is a Canadian lawyer named Louis M. Bloomfield, now the late Louis M. Bloomfield. It has been alleged by some that he worked for U.S. intelligence, that he worked for the OSS in World War II. That was America's World War II intelligence service. And there has also been discussion in a recent book that has been put out in French in Canada by a Montreal researcher named Maurice Phillips that, in fact, the forthcoming, or at least hopefully forthcoming, release of Louis Mortimer Bloomfield's papers will shed light on that. However, there has been a move to further obstruct the long-delayed release of Louis Mortimer Bloomfield's papers. His personal papers were withheld from the public, from journalistic scrutiny, by Bloomfield's wishes, and now, even though there is a move to access the information now that a lot of time has passed, there are some who are suggesting that the ban on releasing those papers should be continued. An article about that appeared in the Gazette, and the address for this will be appeared. This appears to be in fact, this is on the Canada.com website. This is from the Montreal Gazette of January 27th of 2007. The article is by Elizabeth Thompson. Its headline, "Do Lawyers' Files Hide JFK Secrets? Bloomfield Papers. Montreal lawyer's widow asks federal archives to seal husband's documents for at least 25 more years. Why?" one might ask. The article reads in part, "Does the key to the assassination of U.S. President John F. Kennedy lie buried in Canada's National Archives? Or is it another secret that has pitted Montreal researcher Maurice Phillips against Library and Archives Canada and the widow of once prominent Montreal lawyer Louis Mortimer Bloomfield?" One thing is certain. Whatever Bloomfield's widow is trying to keep under lock and key out of concern for privacy and the reputation of Louis M. Bloomfield, unquote, it has left Canada's National Archives wrestling with a dilemma that goes to the heart of the question of who controls access to private documents donated to the federal government. A recent federal court ruling found the institution cannot arbitrarily extend the restriction on access to Bloomfield's papers well past the original deadline set by Bloomfield himself. Now, the Archives is struggling to decide when to lift the veil of secrecy on papers that have been judged of exceptional interest to Canada. Skipping down. At the center of the controversy are 31 boxes of documents that Bloomfield donated to the Archives a few years before his death in 1984. Skipping down again. In addition to correspondence with many prominent Canadian politicians and with George Bush Sr., the collection includes documents relating to a variety of charities in which Bloomfield was active, cases in which he was involved, such as the attempt to bring Romanian King Carol to Canada as a refugee in the Second World War. Skipping down yet again, speaking of Maurice Phillips, the Montreal author who is trying to force the release of the Bloomfield documents. Phillips, author of the book De Dallas à Montréal, which explores a possible Montreal connection to JFK's 1963 assassination in Dallas, stumbled on a reference to the Bloomfield connection in the mid-1990s and was intrigued, particularly given allegations advanced by some JFK conspiracy theorists that tied Bloomfield to the shooting, a company called Permandex, the CIA, and the agency that preceded it, the Office of Strategic Services. While the conspiracy theory connection between Bloomfield and JFK's assassination is a complex one and has evolved over time, it appears to stem from the fact that he was named as a major shareholder in a shadowy international company called Permandex. Among the other people involved in Permandex was Clay Shaw, whom New Orleans District Attorney Jim Garrison suspected was part of a conspiracy to murder the president. There are also allegations Permandex was a front or shell company for the CIA and was used to funnel money for intelligence operations. Some of the theories allege Bloomfield had been recruited into the OSS and that he had ties to intelligence circles, something Harry Bloomfield, that's his son parenthetically, vehemently denies. While Phillips does not believe the papers implicate Bloomfield in the shooting, in fact he believes they may clear Bloomfield's name, he believes they could contain clues that could help shed light on JFK's assassination. Quote, "I think we will find information on people other than him, but I don't think that Mr. Bloomfield was directly linked in a criminal way." So what, if anything, comes out of the long hidden files of Lewis Mortimer Bloomfield? We shall see when and if they are, in fact, declassified. There has been quite a bit of discussion, and justifiable discussion as well, about the Blackwater firm and others of the private contractors that have assumed a growing portion of American national security business in recent years. In particular, the large role played by many of these private contractors, including Blackwater USA in the Iraq War and in the Iraqi wartime economy, the role of those private contractors has come into fairly sharp public view, at least at times, in connection with Iraq. We're going to examine now an article from Harper's that talks about the very close relationship and what is described here as a revolving door between the Blackwater USA firm and the Central Intelligence Agency itself. Blackwater is a private company. By the way, it's CEO now. It's headed up, it's owned by a fellow named Prince, but the guy who runs it now is Joseph Schmidt, the former Inspector General for the Pentagon, son of son of John G. Schmitz, and an individual who's part of an underground Reich milieu that overlaps events of September 11th, 2001. Go to the Spitfire website, as I've counseled so many times. Do use the search engine. Look for Joseph Schmitz. Look for John P. Schmitz and John G. Schmitz. And this connection will come into a clearer view for you. But do note again that Joseph P. Schmitz is the head, that Joseph Schmitz is the head of Blackwater at this point in time. Blackwater not only functions on behalf of the U.S. national security establishment, it has a very close relationship with the Central Intelligence Agency, and indeed, the former Navy SEAL, Mr. Prince, Eric Prince, who is the owner of the company and the founder of the company, he has a very, very close relationship with the Central Intelligence Agency, and all of this is against the background of the privatizing of national security matters. Because indeed, the more that U.S. national business is subcontracted out to private institutions with powerful connections, then to that extent, ultimately it will be out of the view, perhaps out of the control of any reasonable civic oversight in the United States. We've already noted the extent to which General Motors was able to not only move outside of U.S. government control, but indeed, as noted at the very end of the Edwin Black article that with which we began the program, the business of General Motors and the business of America were seen as one and the same. One wonders to what extent people at Blackwater USA and or the Central Intelligence Agency hold the same view. But the relationship between Blackwater, a private company, and the Central Intelligence Agency was the focal point of an article that appeared in Harper's Magazine September 12th of 2006. This is an article by Ken Silverstein. It's titled, "Revolving Door to Blackwater Causes Alarm at CIA." It reads as follows. Blackwater USA, the private security contract that is operated in places such as Iraq, Afghanistan, Azerbaijan, and New Orleans, has been booming in the past few years. Founded in December of 1996, the company spent its early years, quote, paying staff with an executive's credit card and begging for customers, unquote, according to the Virginian Pilot. But today, Blackwater reportedly has revenues of about $100 million annually, almost all of it from government contracts, and maintains, quote, a compound half the size of Manhattan and 450 permanent employees, unquote, according to the newspaper. How did Blackwater rise so high and so fast? The war on terrorism, unquote, got the ball rolling for the firm, but one suspects that political connections played a big part as well. Eric Prince, Blackwater's founder, is a former Navy SEAL who is deeply involved in Republican Party politics. Since 1998, he has funneled roughly $200,000 to GOP committees and candidates, including President Bush. In 2004, Blackwater retained the Alexander Strategy Group, the PR and lobbying firm that closed down earlier this year due to its embarrassing ties to Jack Abramoff and Tom DeLay. Paul Behrens, a former National Security Advisor to Congressman Dana Rohrabacher, handled the account for Alexander. After the firm shut down, Behrens moved on to a firm called CNM Capital Inc. and took the Blackwater account with him. A number of senior CIA and Pentagon officials have taken top jobs at Blackwater as well, including firm Vice Chairman Kofor Black, who was the Bush administration's top counterterrorism official at the time of the 9/11 attacks, and who famously said in 2002, there was before 9/11 and after 9/11. After 9/11, the gloves came off, unquote. Robert Young Pelton, author of the new book License to Kill, says that an early Blackwater contract, a secret, no-bid $5.4 million deal with the CIA, came in 2002 after Prince placed a call to Buzzy Krongard, who was then the CIA's executive director. A CIA source with whom I spoke said that Prince is very tight with top agency officials and has a green badge, unquote, the security pass for contractors who have access to CIA installations. He's over there at CIA headquarters regularly, probably once a month or so, this person told me. He meets with senior people, especially in the DO. The DO, or Directorate of Operations, runs covert operations. Last year, it was absorbed by the newly created National Clandestine Service. Prince's visits are probably one reason that the revolving door to Blackwell keeps turning. Last fall, Rob Ricker resigned from the post of Associate Deputy Director of Operations and immediately took a job as Blackwater's Vice President of Intelligence. Ricker, R-I-C-H-E-R, is a former head of the CIA's Near East Division and long served in Amman, Jordan, for a period beginning in 1989. While there, he held the post of station chief. For years, he was the agency's point man with Jordan's King Abdullah, with whom he developed an extraordinarily close relationship. Quote, "There have been some ups and downs in our relationship with Jordan, but the King has always been on good terms with the CIA," unquote, said a person familiar with the situation. Again, quoting, "The King's primary relationship is always with the CIA, not the American ambassador," unquote. The CIA has lavishly subsidized Jordan's intelligence service and has sent millions of dollars in recent years for intelligence training. After Ricker retired, sources say he helped Blackwater land a lucrative deal with the Jordanian government to provide the same sort of training offered by the CIA. Millions of dollars that the CIA invested, unquote, in Jordan walk out the door with Ricker. If this were a movie, it would be a cross between Jerry Maguire and Syriana. People at the agency are pissed off, said one source. Abdullah still speaks with Riker regularly, and he thinks that's the same thing as talking to us. He thinks Riker is still the man, unquote. Except in this case, it's Riker, not his client, yelling, "Show me the money," unquote. Riker did not return a phone call seeking comment. Meanwhile, there's talk at the agency that Blackwater is also aggressively recruiting Jose Rodriguez, the CIA's current top spy, as director of the National Clandestine Service. Rodriguez has a number of former agency friends at Blackwater, most notably Rick Prado, with whom he served in Latin America and who is now Blackwater's vice president of special programs. One of my sources told me that agency employees had voiced concerns to CIA Director Michael Hayden about the Blackwater revolving door. In a situation like this, there are too many opportunities for people to scratch each other's backs, unquote, he said. Also, from a practical standpoint, it becomes increasingly difficult when national business is conducted through a private corporation. The requisite oversight becomes increasingly complex because, indeed, the general public has no in, so to speak, with a private corporation. They have no cachet with a private corporation and are not necessarily in any position to demand that that business being conducted by the corporation on behalf of the country be held transparent to people, to the citizenry of that country. It's a situation which is already developing and accelerating. It's one that's caused a lot of problems to date and may cause a whole lot more problems. We shall see. By the way, this is not a new trend. It's one that's been developing for a long time. There is a great book that came out in the late 1970s called Spooks by Jim Hogan, last name H-O-U-G-A-N, that covers the topic at considerable length. Nobody who is studying the intelligence community worldwide can afford to overlook Spooks. And the next article that we're going to look at concerns a mysterious death in Iran. This person is held by many to have been one of Iran's top nuclear scientists, although some people dispute that. He died under strange circumstances. Some sources are claiming that his death was an assassination. Some sources are claiming his death was accidental. Some sources are claiming it was a murder by the Mossad, the Israeli Foreign Intelligence Services, and some are claiming that, in fact, this gentleman, Ardashir Hassanpour, was murdered by the Iranian government. And there are, again, disputes about whether he was actually an atomic scientist or rather was involved with rocketry. But whatever the case might be, certainly there is a lot of buzz and a lot of mystery surrounding the recent death of Ardashir Hassanpour. This article is from Forward. That's a Jewish publication out of New York City. It's authored by Mark Perelman, P-E-R-E-L-M-A-N. It is dated Friday, February 16th of 2007, and headlined, "Iranian Scientist's Death Stirs Talk of an Atomic Whodunit," unquote. The escalating confrontation between Iran and the West has produced an atomic whodunit with fingers pointing across the Middle East. Last month, Iran reported the death of Ardashir Hassanpour, H-A-S-S-A-N-P-O-U-R, 44, one of the country's leading nuclear scientists. The news fueled a wave of rumors and conspiracy theories in cyberspace. Radio Farda, which is funded by the U.S. State Department and broadcasts into Iran, reported, quote, "mysterious circumstances," unquote. Iranian dissidents claimed it was a Tehran-ordered hit because Hassanpour, a professor at Shiraz University, quote, "was leaking information to the West," unquote. One U.S. security consulting firm proclaimed that the killing was part of a Mossad effort to thwart Iran's pursuit of a nuclear weapon. None of the above, according to the Iranian government. Tehran blamed the death on a freak accident, saying that Hassanpour died from, quote, "gas suffocation at his home," unquote. The case has generated internet buzz, said Patrick Clausen, deputy director of research at the Washington Institute for Near East Policy. Of course, there are many people wondering if Israel is repeating its successful campaign against scientists working on the Egyptian missile program in the 1960s, he added. "I really don't know what happened," unquote. The first Iranian reports of Hassanpour's demise came January 21st, 6 days after his death, and blamed the tragedy on gas poisoning, unquote, according to Radio Farda. On February 2nd, Stratfor, a company based in the United States, asserted that Israel had ordered a hit on Hassanpour. The company cited very strong intelligence, unquote, that the physicist died from radioactive poisoning, unquote, as part of a Mossad effort to halt the Iranian nuclear program, a theory that was repeated 2 days later in the London Times. And while some observers believed that Tehran would seize upon the charges to blast Jerusalem, the opposite happened. Iranian Vice President Gholam Reza Aghazadeh, who is also head of the country's Atomic Energy Organization, was quickly quoted as saying that all of Iran's nuclear experts, quote, thank God, are sound and safe, unquote. And the Fars News cited an unidentified informed source, unquote, as saying that Hassanpour had been suffocated by fumes from a faulty gas fire in sleep, unquote. The source also rejected as propaganda the theory about Mossad participation. The Israeli intelligence agency, quote, is basically incapable of running operations inside Iran, the source reportedly said. The next day, Alarabiya.net, a Saudi-owned online news service, added a new dimension to the mystery by relaying the claims of Ali Nourizadeh, longtime critic of the regime, that the Iranian government had in fact assassinated Hassanpour. Nourizadeh, a London-based journalist, offered a number of reasons for pointing the finger at Tehran, including the claim that Hassanpour was leaking information about the Iranian nuclear program to Western intelligence agencies. Also, Nourizadeh said Iranian officials were annoyed with Hassanpour's repeated warnings about the danger of an accident at a nuclear reactor. Nourizadeh told Alarabiya that he received an email from Hassanpour 2 weeks prior to his death, in which he expressed his concerns and complained that he was being followed. 2 weeks later, Nourizadeh was quoted as saying, I received a letter from one of his students telling me that the man was killed in his home and that they found his body 3 days later. According to Nourizadeh, Iranian suspicions about the scientist were prompted by a visit he made to Dubai and by the possibility that he met Americans on that occasion. Hassanpour, Nourizadeh added, had decided to stop cooperating with the regime following the election of Mahmoud Ahmadinejad as president in August of 2005, because he saw him as dangerous for the country. But while Nourizadeh described Hassanpour as a genius in the manufacturing of missiles in Iran, who worked for the leading government weapons agency and played a prominent role, unquote, in designing Iranian missiles, the Fars News agency stated that he did not work at nuclear facilities and was merely a university professor at Shiraz. Media reports have stated that he received Iran's most prestigious military research prize in 2004 and the top award at an international science conference last year. Though the mystery remains unsolved, a couple of things are certain. Hassanpour is dead, and footage of his funeral was posted on the internet. So, who killed Mr. Hassanpour? What exactly was he doing? Was he just a missile expert? Was he a nuclear expert? Did he die a natural, accidental death? Or was he killed? And if he was killed, who killed him? Well, do not know. But that, as we say, and as I've said so often on this program, is food for thought and grounds for further research. Please do take advantage of the vast amount of material available on the Spitfire and linked websites, the websites maintained by sister station WFMU, which are archiving the For the Record programs on audio, and also the many, many printed files that are available, the long written descriptions of each For the Record program, the audio files that are available on Spitfire, the books that are available on Spitfire, a tremendous and growing amount of information, literally a cornucopia of anti-fascist information. There's a search function. There also, by the way, is a page to click on to support the work that I'm doing. And if some of this stuff disturbs you, if you don't like what you're seeing, there's no better way of fighting back than supporting the work that I'm doing. This concludes Side 2 of For the Record Program Number 586, Miscellaneous Articles and Updates. This is being recorded on February 19th of the year 2007. My name is Dave Emery. Thanks for listening.